Welcome to Coach Aria's podcast, Coach to Lead. I'm Magda Wozak.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today. In this episode, a panel of coaches from different religious backgrounds explores faith-based limiting beliefs and discusses how the coaching process can lead to interfaith alignment. The episode you're about to hear was recorded live as part of Coach Aria's Coaching Across Boundaries event. You'll find a link to the video recording of the session in the episode notes. For more information on webinars like this one and on becoming a coach, please visit us at coacharia.com. If you like this episode, please don't forget to subscribe. Thank you for your support. Here's the episode.
If you study people like Bruce Lipton, Biology of Beliefs, who's one of the most famous molecular cellular biologists alive today, he says that at cellular level, when you take the human cells and put them in a petri dish or other cells of other creatures who are of a similar species, they all have this phenomenally powerful need and tendency to come together, cluster together, to be inclusive, to be collaborative, to be working together. It's only when there is some toxic substance that is introduced that they then try to fragment, move away purely from survival point of view. Similarly, if you look at quantum physics, there's this whole concept of entanglement where electrons who are all negatively charged and therefore they would have a reason to repel each other, they don't. They get entangled. That's a word that is used in quantum physics. And once they get entangled, it's almost that they are monogamous. They get entangled for life. And wherever they are, the electrons separate. They may be billions of miles, kilometers, whatever distance away, light years away, that entanglement remains. They call that as non-local entanglement. I mean, this is one of the spaces that is currently being studied using these inputs from cellular biology as well as quantum physics. How can we communicate with each other without having the need to be physically in touch, without necessarily using our senses to be able to communicate with each other? Many of the epics that we have, whether it is in Hinduism or Buddhism or other cultures, they do talk about these kind of powers that existed. And today we are trying to figure out scientifically how they exist. However, when it comes to our individual behavior, we do not exhibit any of this. We do not exhibit the autonomous or automatic cellular collaboration that we see at a microcosmic level, as it were, or the entanglement that we see. We are divided, whether we like it or not, we are divided. We believe we are together. Yes, there is this concept called local empathy where we seem to come together when it suits us, but automatically, today it is proven social sciences have provided evidence that this so-called empathy, which exists within a few people, tribal elements, as it were. Usually tribe is referred to a group less than about 100 people. But then they disappear when they start applying it to a much larger level. That means those tribes react and respond without any empathy to a much larger group. There is dissension, there is dissonance, there is violence. One of the things for me is a mystery, is I can understand if, for example, ethnicities, culturally different groups of people, ethnic groups or racial groups or language groups or so, who have grouped together, they understood each other. They behave in a slightly different fashion and sometimes probably at odds with each other. But what really confounds me is there are beliefs of faith, which we today may term as religion. They divide us as brothers and sisters, as parents and children, and literally to the point that we kill each other, we destroy each other. Why does that happen? Why does that totally non-factual, scientific, limiting belief that has been handed down from Moses, as it were, or whoever, govern our lives to the extent, to the detriment of ourselves, and to the detriment of other people, where it could be a much more powerful belief which could enhance the way that we live. This is a question that has bugged me for a long time. I don't have an answer. Every religion that I know has been created by people who are supremely wise and intelligent. And however, when it's been put into practice, it has been put into practice in a way that it's about preservation, it's about control, it's about influencing other people. And those limiting beliefs then bring us to points which create this huge amount of dissension. So recently, or maybe about a year, 2 years ago, when I first came into contact with Otto Scharmer's writings, Theory U, this struck me very, very hard. He beautifully puts together this, that the state of absencing, as he calls it, where we see things happening outside. We see the reality of what is happening outside. We see the horrors of migration problems. We see the horrors of climate change. We see so many other things that are happening out there in this world. However, these beliefs that we have prevent us from seeing them. And we say, hey, it's not happening. There are people out there, global leaders today, say, oh, there's no such thing as climate change. There are guys who are standing for the presidency of countries who talk about God created us in 6 days and he went to rest. We also go to rest. And that is how it should be, which has no scientific, no intellectual, no intelligent support whatsoever. So Scharmer calls this as the closed mind approach, which then closes our heart, which closes our will. And we are there saying, hey, it's not our responsibility. This is not true. This is not happening. People are not fighting. The climate is not harming us. And then you get to a stage, oh, yeah, I can't deny it anymore. It's happening out there. But I'm not responsible for it. What the hell do I have to do with it? Nothing. Until it gets to a point where it really affects you, your children, potentially your grandchildren. And fortunately for us, our grandchildren are able to realize it today and taking action on it, even if we don't. And that is how I see the hope for the future in terms of our millennials. And Scharmer also then talks about this whole concept of how from that downloading state, denial state, refusal state of absencing, we can move into a state of where we can open our minds to what is happening through different kinds of listening, for example, the curious listening, the empathetic listening, the generative listening, open our hearts and open our will to be able to do something about it. And the Theory U program is going on. Many people from Kocharia have sort of joined it. I would strongly advise, request, suggest all of you join it too. And we can form hubs as part of Kocharia or otherwise and do something to change the way the world is today from one of absencing for the most part into something that can be a fantastically beautiful emerging future that Scharmer talks about as the presencing. Now, within that spectrum, today I would really like to bring this panel together as people from different faiths who are coming in here. Some of them may not be obviously of those faiths. You may not look at them as, Ram Charan doesn't look like that he is going to talk about the Hindu faith. He is. He has got as much knowledge about the Hindu faith as I have. Michael about Buddhism. He has studied a lot. Carol about Judaism. And I'm very happy that we have two people here. Irfan has been one of my guides and mentors. When I trained him, he trained with me as a coach in terms of explaining to me what Islam stood for, taking away all the kinds of negative perceptions that one comes up with, how it can be. And I wasn't quite sure that Irfan was going to be. I was getting worried because I know that I met him a couple of months ago and he said he had not been well, so I wasn't quite sure and I hadn't heard from him. I'm totally, truly happy that he showed up. But in the meantime, I requested Shanaz to come and join us just in case, and Shanaz is here. And John is supposed to represent the Christian faith. We haven't had John join us as yet, but Nishmita is a is from a serious Catholic background. So she is here just in case she has to jump in and present her views. I'm sure each of us also contribute to the others. Oh, John is here. Thank you, John. Thanks for joining. So we have more than our share of individual religions being represented here. So as Magda said in the beginning before you all guys came, she was nervous yesterday. And I said, yeah, when you are nervous, you tend to talk a bit. That's fine, because at least you look good. I don't. So and I don't want to talk too much. So make my presence an absence. So I will leave it open to you guys here. So please start whichever way you want. We have talked about a little bit. These are the limiting beliefs that are coming up. Whoever wants to start, all that I would request to the panelists to be, and even from their people in the chat box, be tolerant, be appreciative, be inclusive. There are a lot of things we see there we don't like. But there are a lot of things about us that people don't like either. So it's not as if we are the only people who have the right not to like what is out there. But there are people out there who have the right not to like us as well. So in this process, we as coaches here, can we find some way to be able to reframe what we see, what other people see, and maybe make a small difference in terms of how this world can be better, how the emerging future can truly be better than what it is today. So I'll stop here. Please unmute yourself as you go along. And if you need help in terms of unmuting, let us know, Magda and I. And for all the participants out there, the attendees who are not on the panel, unfortunately, the webinar system doesn't allow us to have every one of you out here. So when you are posting something, please make sure that you are posting as all panelists and attendees, because otherwise you would be only reaching out to the panelists. And when we try to answer your question, we'll have to repeat that question all over again. Whereas if you address it as panelists and attendees, everybody will be able to see you. And in between, if there are any clarification needed, we'll jump in, answer them. Magda has already given you clear instructions in terms of how to apply for the CCUs. Maybe she can post it once again if needed. Now, let me stop talking. Yeah, open it up to my panelists. Whoever wants to jump in, whichever way they want to. Fine, thank you.
Well, Ram, I'll jump in. From a Buddhist point of view, I'm sensing your suffering. Right. And one of the central tenets of Buddhism, of course, is the suffering, often referred to as dukkha. And it's sometimes interpreted as suffering. In actual, that's the Western interpretation. In fact, there are many different interpretations. One of them is that something's out of balance or out of kilter. And so to your point of feeling the frustration of what's going on in the world around us, that we live in a VUCA world, it is very destabilizing. And how do we bring stability back to that? And in the coaching world, of course, this is what our clients bring to us. And they're in a state of dissatisfaction or unbalanced or a form of suffering, if you will. And as coaches, we are there to help facilitate the understanding of that in a way that they can move on it. And how that ties in with theory U, as I understand it, is that, like you said, at the bottom of the U, you have the presencing. And in order to get there, you have to acknowledge and then let go and let come. And of course, in Buddhism, that is done largely through the practice of meditation. It's also done with the orientation of loving kindness, of non-attachment to the results, which very much folds into with what coaching is in terms of working with your client, that you're not so attached to their results that you start to influence the discussion. But more to the point of what you're talking earlier about religions and people behaving badly. It's across all religions, including Buddhism. And that's largely down to the ego. And again, if that's taken into account and understood, then there can be greater awareness and greater acceptance of moving towards better understanding, and to your point of tolerance, patience, and inclusiveness. So that's my little intro there, and I'll let others jump in now.
Yeah, Michael, before others jump in, I just want to make a point based on what is in the chat box out here.
Yeah.
A couple of people have pointed out, what about atheism? Mm-hmm. What about non-belief? I totally accept and understand that. In fact, strangely, I would consider myself an atheist, or at least an agnostic. I don't believe in anything called God. I do not believe in a form called God. I do not believe in a teaching about God. In fact, the scriptures that I believe in, though they happen to come from the Hindu religion, the Upanishads, mm-hmm. which are some of the oldest wisdoms ever put down, they do not talk about a God anywhere. They just talk about an energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I believe in. And therefore, some of you who have pointed out, is there someone representing atheism? If anybody has to represent atheism, I would represent atheism. But if atheism means that it is all about us, the René Descartesian kind of philosophy, I think therefore I am, I think that is not my belief. Because I do believe that there's something outside of us. There's a natural intelligence that is governing this whole universe and whatever created us and whatever makes us be sustainable. And to that extent, we live in consonance with a larger system. And that is what spirituality is about. Somebody referred to here is, mm-hmm. Are we talking about religion here? Are we talking about spirituality here? The moment we start entering into the zone of spirituality, I think all that I talked about earlier, whether it is Bruce Lipton or the entanglement and so on, they start happening. Because spirituality is moving out from your own skin into this much larger element of energy, being one with the other. Whereas I believe that the moment you put down the word religion and faith and everything, it comes back to what you said. It comes back into the ego. That Sharma again talks about this egocentricity.
Mm-hmm.
Egocentricity to me is my definition, I may be completely be wrong, is religion, whereas ecocentricity is spirituality. So the movement from religion to spirituality in a larger sense is what would probably liberate us. So I'll stop there. This is completely controversial, I may be completely wrong, but no, for what it is worth.
Yeah, no, and again, I hear you're struggling with this and trying to reconcile many things. Buddhism, I consider a philosophy more than a religion. The Buddha famously said, if anybody calls himself Buddha, slay them, because there can only be one. There's only one of each one of us. And Buddhism is a non-deity based religion for some people. It believes in non-duality, that we're all interconnected. It's not us and them. All of us are interconnected. The eco, to your point, we cannot exist without air, without water, without others. And everything that gives us sustenance. So at the base of Buddhism is an acknowledgement that everything is interconnected and that we're constantly energy being recycled. I just read somewhere recently that at this point in time, each one of us has breathed the same air as Angus Khan has. You know, we breathe it in, we breathe it out, and it gets recycled. And that's part of also the Buddhist philosophy, this idea of constant cycling of spirituality and of energy.
Irfan here. So Ram and we had a discussion around this earlier, and I very strongly believe that religions, all religions are scientific. It's just that our science currently may not have been developed so much where we understand the science behind the actions that each of the religions ask us to do. I'll take a very classic example, that the formation of the embryo has been explained in the Quran. And 1400 years ago, we did not have the technology to understand that. So some of the things that we do are kind of put onto us because the science has not developed as much for us to understand, as and they're put down as rituals and rules. And some of them sound or, you know, feel very stupid to us. But I guess as science evolves over a period of time, we'll realize that, oh, okay, this is the reason why a lot of us have been asked to do this.
Hello, everyone. Shanaz here from Cape Town. I'm really passionate about working in the field of, you know, building bridges, doing diversity and inclusion work. It's a big part of how this work found me and how it blends with how I frame my own identity as a Muslim woman, and how I step into the work. And for me, a big marker of my own identity is my relationship with my Creator, is my Islam, and how I understand it, how I practice it, how I live it. It for me, at the core, it invites me to a sense of my being as, you know, as how am I being fully human in relation to other human beings wherever I meet up with them. So for me, one of the big, the usual suspects, I call them, of identity markers, and from a South African perspective, it's often race, gender, and class. Those are often your top three markers. And then, you know, religion and language are also other dominant markers of identity. And these deep identities I find in the work that I get the privilege to do, often, you know, when we talk about religion and people's passions and how attached we are to that part of our identity and how dominant it is, and how emotionally charged people are. And that's why, Ram, in your opening background statement around how people get to kill each other in the name of religion, as a very sad reality today still. It's around what are some of the deep, I'm curious about the deep conflicts there are about how religion is understood and misunderstood. And Islam is one of those religions. Yes, there are extremists. And as Michael said, across, you know, every religion, we can tell stories about extremism in our practice and the understanding and the propaganda around what the faith entails and what it's not. And for me, working in this field as, you know, a Muslim woman, I'm curious and I often play with it to see how people respond to the notion of visible markers of identity. So I wear a headscarf, right? And sometimes when I step into different spaces to do work in the world, what does my scarf mean to you? And what does it evoke in how I get engaged, how I engage, what the culture is that I'm stepping into, and how lightly do I carry my own set of beliefs? And how does it, you know, get either in the way of doing the work, you know, in the world, and when does it serve me? And I think for me, lastly, for now, religion and often, you know, looking at Islam and the diversity within Islam. There's so many different schools of thought, so many different practices. You can go to different mosques and there would be different practices around Islam, and there's no one group that holds the monopoly interpretation and practice of Islam. So there's a struggle. There's a wrestling within that as well. And there's a very rich spectrum and diversity within Islam. And we know religion includes and religion excludes in a number of different ways in which it gets practiced. And I think that's often where the deep conflict resides as well. I'll pause there for now. Thanks for the platform, Ram and colleagues.
Yes, so I want to share a little something from the Christian perspective. And I have been someone who actually dabbled in trying to find my own spiritual religious identity. When in, back in 1993, I went for a program in Buddhist meditation called Vipassana. Some of you may have attended. And I was so smitten by it that I contemplated turning a Buddhist. Then somewhere along, I grew up in a family which was predominantly Catholic. So we used to go to church every Sunday. But, you know, for the life of me, I could not fathom what it meant to be a Christian, which is where I started my search. This was, you know, well over 26, 27 years ago. And then I kind of did a little roundabout came to getting back to the God of the Bible. Started reading. You know, up until then, I had no clue what it meant for me as a Christian that Jesus came and died for me. I had no, absolutely no. And for me to undergo that process of trying to understand and make that connection was a deep spiritual awakening of sorts. And today I stand in that place where I don't want to think of it as religion, but I would like to think of it as a relationship. And that's relationship, like Shehnaz mentioned, with our creator, it's a relationship with my creator. And we may sit here and argue about who that creator is, including whether that creator exists. But that's a topic for another time. But here I was reflecting on what the scriptures had to say. And I was thinking about certain portions of scripture that seemed to contradict with other portions of scripture. And so I was talking to my voice teacher, who's also a Bible teacher. And I was asking him this question. And he said, John, why can't you accept both those dualities? And I felt comfortable with that idea. Because ultimately, if I think about the law as the law interpreting the law, it's about scripture interpreting scripture. And when I look at the differences, like Shailendra Jha pointed out, it is the differences that seem to take us apart. But when I focus on what unites us, what binds us, you know, having grown in Mumbai, in a city that is extremely diverse, with friends from literally every different form of religion. We never saw each other as different. And even today, thanks to Carl Rogers, I don't see anybody as different. And so for me, somebody's religion, somebody's race, somebody's ethnicity, somebody's sexual orientation, somebody's beliefs are not really something that I focus on. But I choose rather to focus on what unites us. And if you think back to what we talk about quantum physics, if you think back about what we talk about genetics, the fact that we are so similar racially is what we should look at factors that bind us. And I'm reminded of the time that, if you look at, I want to share a little story in the Bible. This is from the Gospels, where the sin of adultery was condemned by stoning. And there was a woman caught in adultery in the Bible, and she was hauled before Jesus. And Jesus didn't say anything. He stooped down and he was writing something in the sand. And then he said these words. He said, "The one of you which is without sin, please cast the first stone." And it said there, that they left that place, starting from the eldest to the youngest, until he was left with the woman. And he looked at her and he told her that sin no more, and he let her go. And for me, that is really the epitome of what our interaction should be, which is interactions based on grace, interactions based on loving people, because that's what I'm called to do. My God has said that thou shalt love your Lord thy God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, all your strength. Thou shalt love your neighbor like yourself. He didn't say who that neighbor was. He didn't say that you should love a neighbor of a specific color or creed or race or religion. He said, love your neighbor. And that's what I'm called to do. And that's what I believe in. And I believe in looking at what unites us instead of what divides us. I'm going to stop here now.
I'd like to add a little bit there. So growing up, we'd learn a lot of hymns. And back then, I'd just sing them, but I wouldn't really know the value behind them or the message behind them. But as life teaches you lessons, I think these come in handy because they tell you something. So I clearly remember this point in time where I was going through a bit of a dark time, and I was just lying in bed thinking of how I'm not worthy of love. It was this time when I really wanted to go to church. I really wanted to go and pray, but I thought that I'm not worthy of God's love. And something my sister said struck me. I mean, she spoke about how God's love is unconditional. And till then, that term was always there, but I never really understood what it meant because I didn't explore the concept of unconditional love myself. But, and she also said another thing. She said that the opposite of love is not hate. The opposite of love is fear. And fear comes from a lack of understanding love, and from fears can stem hate. So that in itself was a very relieving feeling for me. And I thought about these lines from this hymn. It says, God is dwelling in my heart, he and I are one. And then I was like, yeah, I mean, God is already here. Like, I have him in my heart. And that's where I think, since God is love, it's self-love and all of these terms. That's why I guess coaching can be such a spiritual journey, like for both the coach and the person undergoing the coaching, because it's all about finding that love. And when you understand that love for yourself, well, if you can love yourself, then who can't you love, right? So yeah, that's just what I wanted to add.
That's really beautiful. I'd like to add just a few things here. You know, John, you said before, you quoted, you know, about the neighbor, and it's love your neighbor as yourself. And I think when we look at that on a spiritual level, it also demands of us to love ourselves. And not only to be in the place where we are in judgment, but to actually love ourselves. You know, I believe that all of the world's major religions put an emphasis on the compassion and the patience and the tolerance, on the forgiveness. And we have so many common values between all of us, even if our belief systems may be different. And even if we have things in our belief systems that limit us in some way, coaching allows us to open up that place and the ability to see how our values and how our experiences it can have a huge impact on the world, even if it's beginning by coaching one-on-one. And it's a place where, when I look at the cultural diversity, which is the field that I originally come from, we see that the more we learn about each other, the more we learn about ourselves. And I think we need to recognize the assumptions that we have out there. I grew up in a home that was first Reformed and then conservative and then religious and then ultra religious. And I had to find my own beliefs of God being within ourselves, or the universe being within ourselves, and our creating a new reality. So that's my beginning.
I think, you know, we would all agree that if we look at religious faiths, you know, it's really about what connects us to ourself and to the universe. It just seems to be a general theme here. And, you know, it seems to me that the problems, the clashes are psychological. They're not religious. You know, and that each person, you can say that a certain religion has 100 million followers, but actually there will be 100 million versions of that religion, because it's a personal thing. You know, the difference I see is that, you know, Sharma talks about moving from ecosystem to ecosystem. That's more the question of how to assist people and how to assist society to transcend the limited self, because the limited self will always interpret whatever teachings it's presented with. It will always interpret that in a way that reinforce its own beliefs. And typically, you know, if you start looking at some of the models like spiral dynamics or something, when consciousness is in a more kind of lower level understanding of self, it will see other as a threat. The shift is more, I think, initially, how can we as coaches embody what we see as the real essence of our religion or our spiritual belief or our faith, embody that to such a deep degree that we bring that into our coaching, not explicitly, because we're not there to function as missionaries, but to empower our clients to make that sort of vibrational shift to a deeper state of self. So the line that's been coming up for me in the past couple of minutes of the discussion also is from the Gita, where Krishna says, I am the self seated in the hearts of all beings. I am the beginning, the middle, and the end of all beings. So it doesn't matter whether you call that Krishna or not, but just to understand one simple basic teaching like that is profoundly transformative. And I think that all religions, even Buddhism, where there's no self there to be in the heart of all beings, it's just, you can call it Buddha nature or emptiness or whatever, but they'll all lead to that place of recognizing that self and other are the same. So, you know, I begin to try to look at the conversation in terms of a coaching conversation. If the goal is inclusion and tolerance, first we come to that place ourselves as coaches, and then work with whoever we're working with, not with a bias towards inclusion and tolerance, but from that place, inviting that consciousness in the other. In my experience traveling around the world and speaking with people from all different religions, there is nobody, let's say I can count on the fingers of one hand the people who I've met who I've not been able to connect with, just as human beings, as consciousness to consciousness. So that's my input for right now, but I'm glad to see what else comes out of this.
Thank you very much for the last person who spoke. What was your name?
Ramcharan.
Ramcharan. Oh,
thank you very much. I'm so struck by what you said, that many of the clashes are psychological, actually. They're not religious. And I saw a program many years ago by a filmmaker who interviewed all the leaders of all the world religions at that time. We're going back to the 70s now. And he said, I got them all into one room at the end of the film, and they didn't even speak to each other. They just sat together in their beingness. And that told me a great deal, that actually when clashes occur, there are clashes because people take a fundamentalist position. I'm right and you're wrong. And this is the difficulty. It's not the religion itself, the set of beliefs, but our attitudes towards them. And this brings us back to the question of identity. My identity is better than yours. What? You know, I think it's really important that we understand what's just been said about the clashes are psychological. And when people are afraid that somehow their view of the world isn't shared, then they don't matter anymore. So it's very interesting to explore the motives of people who fight about their religion. This is my territory, my belief. And if you don't believe me, then you think I don't matter. So that's kind of my immediate thought just now.
I just want to jump
right on. Yeah,
sorry, I'm sorry. I just want to jump in with a couple of comments here and some of the stuff that I see on the chat. Yeah, there's a point that is being made that in coaching, religion has no place completely. In ego doesn't have a place either. Therefore, our thoughts do not have a place. Our judgment doesn't have a place. But the question is, can you turn your lens inwards and see that you don't carry any of those biases in one way or another? Religion is just not a word. Ramcharan used the word psychology, but it's far more than psychology. It becomes physiology when it involves physical conflicts, people killing each other. So someone talked about sociology. Is it a sociological problem? It's everything. Ultimately, it arises as that glimmer of an electron firing in your brain between the neurons and the synapses. And it creates a thought, and the thought creates a belief, and the thought belief creates an action. And that's what we are talking about. And we can keep on semantically saying, no, we shouldn't talk about this. Christopher makes a point that the Buddhist monk pointed out, and then we should, I don't know what he meant by it, but what I interpret from there is, can you suffer in silence rather than criticizing it? Personally, I wouldn't. I mean, to be honest, Ramcharan has that experience. I was trying to be a monk for 6 years. I found it was a total hypocrisy, personally. And pretty much everybody who I met there were people who were trying to renounce something and believe that they are renouncing something, but not renouncing anything, really. Full of the same garbage, probably, that I had, but not accepting it. So, because somebody wears a monk's robe, does it automatically elevate them to a position that they are guides to us? We don't know enough about that. What is far more important is for us to be aware of the garbage that we are carrying within ourselves. If that is possible, if you are able to look within and see, hey, these are the biases that we carry. Somebody made a difference between, I try to make the difference between the self with a small s and the self with a capital S. There's a huge difference. The small self is the ego. That's a filter, the conditioned filter, which makes us interpret everything in a way that we are used to, what Otto Sharma calls the downloading part. And that is what makes us absent, closed in mind, heart, and will. Now, can we break away from it? And in order to break away from it, the first thing is, like what Nishmita said very, very simply, to just be aware, yes, that we have the biases. And then accept that we have the biases. And in spite of it, fine, I love myself. But can I be different? Can I be without that bias? And I just would like you to explore that. Because, yeah, there are multiple views. I agree with, I mean, honestly, nobody can disagree with any of what people are saying out there. But how does it land on somebody else? How congruent are you? Carl Rogers uses this beautiful word, congruence. Many people don't even understand what it is. The congruence is about, he says, when I talk about unconditional positive regard, I'm not a Pollyanna. I don't believe that everybody is fantastic. Everybody has noble intentions. But in spite of it, if I'm truly able to share what I feel within, my thoughts are in alignment with what I say and what I act with the other person, and say it in a way that is beneficial to the other person, that is good enough for me as an unconditional positive regard. I'm paraphrasing Carl Rogers, but that's what it is. It doesn't mean that everybody is out there beautiful in any which way, or that we are beautiful. But we have the ability to be able to interpret other people being beautiful and us being beautiful. Does that make a shift? And that's what, for example, in religions like Sufism, I find tremendously powerful. That it's all about that ultimate gratitude and surrender to something. And that makes a difference within us. I think some of you, Nishmita, Shanaz, and other people refer to that. So yeah, I'll just leave it open to you.
You know, I want to add just one more thing, if possible. There's a West African proverb that says, the stranger sees what he knows. And I think that it's true, we need to leave the ego out of it totally, okay? And come into coaching, for example, with a very clear and open unknowingness, if I can say, with, you know, with our coaches. But we need to remember at the same time that it's a level of awareness. That is, we reach different levels of awareness, then we're able to accept, we're able to learn, accept, and respect. We have so many different religions on here, and that we each know so little about, and it's so easy to jump in and say, well, I know this, this, and this, where we actually don't, because we are all in the same, we're all entangled, as you said before, Ram. The negative electrons as they come together. And to bring that into the coaching discussion, I think is very important.
May I enter on this theme and connecting it to what you're saying, Carol, and the ego references that was made by other panelists? In Islam, you know, the one of the biggest battles or jihads that, you know, individuals like myself, you know, wrestle with, if we are conscious about it, is, you know, wrestling our ego, the jihad, you know, of the ego, you know, and how that gets in the way of us seeing the other human being, and our own state of being in relationship, you know. So I just wanted to make that connection about, you know, the jihad of the ego, which is a big part of our work when we do it consciously.
Yeah, and I would say, I'm with my background, I can interpret that or relate to that in terms of sadhana, you know, that which basically means spiritual practice. And, you know, that to find any source of conflict I experience in the world, to look within myself and see where that is reflecting something in my own consciousness, and not to look outside. For instance, I mean, there are many, many, many forms of spiritual practice out there. What I've come to with coaching is that coaching is a sadhana. And in that, to be present with somebody and to be very completely aware responses and see where my biases are and have the humility and honesty to let those go in service to the other's process, in my experience, is a very deep, genuine form of spiritual practice. And it's it's kind of a continuation of what I've been doing before and an interesting direction to evolve in when I take it as such. So I don't know what people, how you respond to that.
Well, that definitely resonates with me too, of course, this idea of being present. Ram talked about Carl Rogers and the unconditional positive regard. In Buddhism, that translates as loving kindness. And with regards to ego, Pema Chodron, the Buddhist monk out in Nova Scotia here in Canada, talks about Shen Pa. And as a coach, the idea of getting hooked. What are you getting hooked on? And being aware of when you're getting hooked. And also the client, what are they getting hooked on? What's going on there that's causing them to suffer? And how can we create self-awareness in that instant in a way that helps further the discussion that deals with the psychological interpretation? And to Carol's point about the stranger sees what he knows, yes, we often see the things that we want to see, that we as coaches look for something that go, ah, okay, now I know where this client is going. I can work with him now or her now. And again, to catch yourself in that moment saying, ah, I'm making an assumption here. That's my ego. And ego likes to control, to the point that Ram was making at the very top, you know, this idea of control. that comes with everything. And that's the ego saying, I want to control this situation. Now, there is a bit of a duality going on when we're coaches, because we are kind of compelled to control, or better stated, guide the session, because we have finite session minutes. We have to get to some sort of resolution or some sort of action for the client, in a way that that we're constantly clicking on and off with our own presence and our own role and responsibility. But at the end of the day, what is our level of awareness, and how can we catch ourselves in that moment and realize, is this my ego, or is this my intention that's overriding or in service of the client? And so presence is all important, but intention and purpose necessarily has to be part of that dynamic in coaching. It's not just enough to be present. There has to be a co-partnering. I mean, that is part of the definition. To co-partner with the client means that you have to work with the client. Yes, you work with them on their agenda, but you work with them in your agenda by being also open and vulnerable yourself, recognizing your own biases. I remember I had a client that triggered me one day when he said, I said, how are you doing? And he said, well, I had a great weekend. I shot 3 deer and a moose. Now, I have rescue animals, and violence towards animals is very, you know, I caught myself. I mean, I could see my body tensing up. I could feel my mind shutting down, going, okay, I don't want to work with this client anymore. And then the Buddhism part of me said, no, this person is expressing something that they may not be enjoying. I'm interpreting it that they enjoyed it. And in the end, through further discussion, I found out that he didn't particularly enjoy it, but he just felt peer pressure. So again, this whole idea of awareness within myself, awareness with him, and awareness of my own bias or interpretation of whatever's coming through. So where am I getting hooked? The Shen Pa. Where am I? Where is Mara, the Indian goddess of temptation, showing up and saying, am I going to hook you with this? A la Ram, who likes to hook us in these discussions. And I'll leave it at that for now.
I mean, that was beautiful, Michael. Absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And I like the part about, as coaches, we all seem to think that even when we coach, we are in an ICF assessment space between 20 and 60 minutes. And by the end of it, we have to display our competencies. That's not true. Mm. We just don't need to do anything. But we can't be in silence either, like what Christopher says, or some of you responded. Yes, it's very, very important to be silent, to be able to reflect, to be able to share what we feel. But ultimately, as coaches, we do have an internal responsibility, not to the outcome, but to be authentic, to be genuine. And that is what unconditional positive regard is, to be congruent with what is happening within us. Like you said, for instance, if I had been the coach in your position, a client said that, and this is what is happening to me. Probably if I were to really go by my immediate impulse to say what I feel, but in a very, very, let's say, appropriate way, I'll have to find that appropriate way. You know, I'm glad that you enjoyed it. I'm glad you enjoyed killing the moose and the rabbits and the hares and whatever else it is. But, you know, in my belief system, destroying another creature, another life, is not something that I would enjoy. But I'm truly glad that you enjoyed. Probably that would have brought up something more. I don't know. I mean,
well, that's an excellent point, Ram. And yeah. I for a second, I thought about addressing it. And actually saying, you know, this is not sitting well with me, and I need a moment to reflect on this. But I also had another awareness saying that if I did that, I was now going to influence the session in a way that it was not intended. And so I had to park all that and say, you know what, that was not what he came in to discuss. I checked in with him. He's expressing it. Unconditional positive regard, loving kindness. This is a person who's here in front of me, who's willing to examine more of his life. I'm going to bank it for now. and maybe it'll come up later in a session. But the moment I realized that if I was going to state my bias at that point, I knew that then I was going to be affecting the relationship in a way that suddenly he might be more defensive now and go, oh. And to that point, I said, no, in service of this client, I have to just let that go and recognize it that I'm getting hooked. And that's my ego. That's one part of my ego, and let it go. Mm-hmm. And to your point of mindlessness, that's where you have to be kind of let it go. And to Otto Scharmer's point, you know, be fully present.
Yeah, Michael, I agree with you. I'm not in disagreement, but what I'm saying is, you know, if you try this and you can see, I found this effect makes a difference somehow, even if it is at odds with what the client's views are. But the point is, it's coming up for you. That is what you feel as a Buddhist or otherwise, that what is being done is wrong. One is to, let's say, subsume it, suppress it, and go with what we think is of value to the client. And the other is letting it go, and letting it go in that sense, but letting it go by putting it out in a very, very non-judgmental way, as a pure observation. And Christopher used a phrase about this monk, which is, I really resonates for me, pointing out. As he says in Tibetan Buddhism, it has a specific meaning. The pointing out is a purely mindless observation without any bias. Hey, this is what I see happening. Now, if more of us were able to do it in more circumstances and without any compulsion, with any desire to control the other person, perhaps maybe there is something different. I don't know. I'm just leaving it out there as a thought. And the other is, going back to what you said, is a very important point. Now, the original meaning of the word dukkha in Buddha's terminology, unfortunately interpreted as sorrow in English, mm-hmm. has got nothing to do with sorrow. It is just the movements of the mind. It keeps jumping from happiness to sorrow to something else, something else, something else. And ultimately, the space that you wish to be in is the equanimity, which mm-hmm. Buddha called the emptiness or the sunya. Now, the emptiness doesn't mean it is an absence. In fact, in another context, a famous Hindu philosopher, Shankara, talks about something called purna, which is completeness. Mm-hmm. And they mean exactly the same. Sunya is the opposite, seemingly, of purna, but they are identical. The sunya is about the emptiness of the ego, which leads to a complete energy. And purna is about that energy. And in a sense, I mean, I'm not trying to promote it here. The Kocharya symbol is about that.
Right.
Zero on top of the infinity. The zero about the emptiness of the mind, the mindlessness, and the infinite space is energy. And that is really where, in a way, I would like to look at the paradigm, at the metaphor of religion and spirituality as well. When religious becomes zero in its desire to control, in its desire to be egocentric, then it can become spirituality, which is infinite, which is compassion, which is kindness, which is love, which is the infinite possibility. So that's another way of looking at it.
Thank you for that, Ram. I just want to add a parenthesis to all of this, because I see some comments coming in here on the chat about, you know, how my reaction was and how I would deal with it. And you talked about subsuming it. That's why coaching supervision is now part of the process for all coaches. That as a coaching supervisor for coaches who experience any type of situation where they gain new awareness about themselves, their biases, or any issues or challenges that come up for them, that they can now go to coaching supervision and discuss this in a way that is highly supportive, highly exploratory, in the way of giving better service for clients, and also greater capacity and competency for coaches to deal with those momentary issues or bigger challenges, systemic changes, whatever. So as a coaching supervisor, I often deal with coaches who are dealing with similar issues. But biases, we all have biases. Our cultural, socioeconomic backgrounds, everything is a bias. What is affecting us as coaches? What is affecting the client beyond the obvious? And to your point about spirituality, I firmly believe in the saying, we are not human beings seeking a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. Oh. Together we exist, together we suffer, and together we recreate each other. Yeah. And that is the spiritual energy that Buddhism puts out there. And whether it's in the form of Dharma, whether it's in the form of karma, samsara, which is prevalent here, of course, all these aspects, ultimately, what's your degree of awareness about yourself and the way your ego is driving the dynamic?
Just want to express a deep appreciation that's, reconfirmed during this conversation. The amount of learning that I'm taking in from fellow panelists from different religious traditions and insights and perspectives. And it just reminds me of, as a coach, what's part of my work of how do I become more culturally literate, and step into the world of that which I understand very little of. What do I need to learn more about Buddhism? What's the little that I know about Hinduism? And the curiosity that's been stirred by, the many dimensions of what you're talking about. I mean, I absolutely love Pope Francis. I think he's an amazing, inspiring human being, at this time in our history. So Catholicism and, the work that Pope Francis stands for, he's a big teacher of mine. And I can hold my own identity as a Muslim without it feeling it's being in conflict with learning and leaning into understanding different traditions. So I just want to say thanks for the learning that I'm taking in. Mm.
I have a question about this, and particularly for Ram at this point, is that, also just really loving the discussion, and I'm enjoying how, as a group of coaches, we can come together and start to dive deep into the meaning of these things. But it seems, as was put out initially for this discussion, that it's a time of great socio-political upheaval, and I would add, ecological trouble in the world, and that, we can start to look at this from the perspective of what we're discussing, and I would say to, as one drops the sense of small self, that we can do in a coaching conversation, ideally, one begins to experience oneself as the larger totality, and there's a deep sense of, interrelatedness, not just with the person you're coaching, but with, with the world. I think coaching as a field has a lot to offer society in a bigger picture way. And I think it's great to have these inspiring discussions amongst ourselves. What I'm really curious about is, if we're going to be unbiased as coaches and be really neutral, how do we then apply this to a problem that would seem to be very urgent and a bigger picture kind of global level? And the only thing that really comes up in my mind is for, coaches who work with business leaders, for instance, to bring in more presence-based coaching. For instance, that's just one idea. And I'm aware there are several, coaches and organizations out there doing that, but how to bring this discussion into the political arena in a way that's going to have any major effect is a real question that crosses my mind, not just today, but pretty often. If anyone wants to speak about any ideas about that.
Ram, could I ask you to teach me a little more about what you mean when you say presence-based coaching?
Well, you know, you can look at it from a, I've heard it described from the point of view of there's a spectrum between being and doing, and that the more transactional coaching is more on the doing end of the spectrum, where we're really looking at, it's action-based, it's looking at specific situations. It's not so much going deeply into the nature of identity. And, you know, as we inquire more deeply into the who, we shift out of doing and even modes of doing and towards a sense of being. So presence-based coaching really is more firmly rooted in the coach holding a state of deep presence and neutrality in themselves, like we've been talking about, kind of not so much focusing on the time, space, identity, and moving back to essence, which will tend to invite that or invoke that in the person or people we're working with. And I'm sure, Fiona and Michael, you could add quite a lot to that.
So Ram Irfan here, and if I could just pick up where you stopped. One of the things that we could start with at that level is to understand and unravel or the core of an individual. And you talk about multiple tests. One of them talks about the social identity test, where you have talk about the chosen, the given, and the core. But and as you unravel that in your coaching conversation, one would probably be able to understand where the core comes from and create probably a little more insight to that individual on the belief system. And that might create some aha moment for transformation. And I'm just trying to put thoughts over here. Not too sure, never tried it, but worth exploring.
I just wanted to, you know, pick from what Ram Charan spoke about, the aspect of sadhana and how a coaching experience truly can become an extremely spiritual experience. And as I was reflecting on the 11 core competencies of ICF, I can't help but marvel that in many ways they are extremely spiritual. You know, right from the code of ethics and CC1, going all the way to actions. You know, a state of being and doing is encapsulated within these competencies. And many ways they reflect who we are as people and the quote unquote religions that we come from. So, in a microcosm, we are getting a spiritual experience when we are coaching at a very deep level, because it needs you to bring to bear your sense of being, your sense of non-judgment, your sense of love, love, which is where this whole concept of unconditional positive regard comes in, and this belief in the highest potential of the people that we coach, which is really nothing but looking at people from the lens of their own unlimited potential. And in many ways, this, you know, to my mind, seems like a very spiritual thing to do, this whole concept of coaching. And to, you know, what Michael alluded to, you know, or I think was it Ram who said, Ram Charan, who spoke about, you know, how do we take this, to larger aspects of society, whether it's political or social or changes like that. And, you know, for me, my dream is really of a world where we start living some of these things to a point where we start having conversations rooted in some of these principles and truly believing that, truly living those, my mind would help us to, you know, in a way diminish much of the pressure that is brought to bear, whether it's religious pressure, political pressure, you know, where I meet participants in some of my workshops from different countries and I talk to them and I realize, you know, the sameness that we enjoy, you know, it doesn't matter which part of the world they are from, what religion they belong to. You talk to them and you start conversing with them at a deeper level and you realize that fundamentally, we are very similar. It's all our sameness that brings us together. And for me, that is extremely thrilling, that we could in a sense be different, and yet we could be part of a bigger whole.
Yeah, Ramchan, going back to the point that you raised, and this has a relevance to what Michael said. If the coach's role is to be neutral, or the neutrality is interpreted as silence, and all that you are doing there, being completely silent or neutral, are we really doing a service to the client? That's the first thing that occurs to me. Michael knows this very well. He spoke about supervision, and I've spoken about several times in the last few days. There is I6 in the Peter Hawkins model of supervision, where the supervisor is mandatorily required if you follow the 7I model. What the supervisor feels about what the coach just said. It's not about, he's just repeating, hey, this is what I hear you saying, and this is what I sense somatically, blah, blah, blah. But honestly, congruently expressing what the coach feels, but with no attachment. And that's really the difference. Even as you say it, you can let it go. And Christopher used this phrase, which I really resonate with in the chat, and Michael is very familiar with it, being a Buddhist, the pointing out. When the Buddha points out to the lady who came to him saying that my child is dead, you are the only person who can revive that child, what Buddha did was to point it out to her in a slightly indirect way. Go and bring me a spoonful of mustard from any household which has never experienced death. And by that experience, that lady was able to understand. So coaches can do that. So the coach's role is not to be silent and watch the world suffer, and they also suffer and be depressed and go through that dukkha and sorrow. That is not what is meant by coaching. Coaches need to perform an active role, not a passive role. You can be the potential energy, but do not lead, influence, control the client. There's a vast difference between the two, how you do it. And therefore, my belief system tells me, more and more I experience coaching and training people to be coaches, I think it makes a huge difference when you not only sort of play back to the client as to what you have heard the client say, or what you sense the client feeling, et cetera, et cetera, but at least once in a while, express to the client, hey, you said something powerful, whether powerfully positive or powerfully maybe reflecting the state of the disempowerment of the client. And this is what is coming up for me. And if you notice, Fiona, in her conversation with Jane 2 days ago, she said that she did that a few times. And that is really where, to me, the power, the magic, and the mastery of coaching is. Somehow we seem to think as coaches that to talk about what you sense, feel, and think at that point in time is inappropriate. It is leading. It is not. It is what your intent is. If your intent is the full conditional, unconditional positive regard for the other person, the generative visioning Otto Sharma talks about, you should always be able to express it in a way that is going to be of benefit to the client. But that's my point of view. And I would stay with it, irrespective of what a competency may say. And I see a competency do not prohibit that. Your intuition is allowed. Your control of the client is not allowed. And the same thing is, that is why, I mean, Otto Sharma talks about this whole process of absencing, is you see things happening. And we don't want to say anything about it. the silent majority. The scourge of the world is not the active evil minority, but the scourge of the world is the attitude of the silent majority who are not willing to speak up. But that doesn't mean you need to lead a revolution. You can point out and let it be. I'll stop there.
Ram, I feel energized and compelled to join you on what you're putting out. And I was taken, when I listened to Michael's example, I was taken back to an experience with a client where the client made what a reference that I interpreted, given my own politics, as potentially a very racist statement. And, you know, the choice I exercised in the moment of challenging her on it, and all, you know, how that, you know, and the risk of the impact of how that influences the tone and the direction of the space, and how restless I felt after the session, that, you know, the issue wasn't, you know, sufficiently aired, and I had to take that into supervision as well. But also it gave me some sense of some of the work that we still need to do between me and this person, that it's an important value, that if we are going to work together, we're going to need to be able to be very honest with each other. So that was just something that how I need to challenge myself to be authentic and show up. And be brave and take a risk and show up with courage and challenge with respect, but also where there's the edginess of the conversation, to let the edginess do its own work with respect and unconditional regard. That's been a curious place for me.
I sense the one thing that's coming across from all of us here is the degree of awareness, tolerance, acceptance, unconditional positive regard. And if you had to sum it up in one word, I know this is something Fiona is not familiar with at all. I'm being sarcastic here. The word love, of course, you know, that's central to it all. Love. It disarms. And it allows. And if you can always put yourself in a position of love, love for your client, love for the fact that they're bringing their issues to you, love for the fact that you are there to provide a service for them, I think whatever religious background you have, that's probably at the heart of it. And I think when you lead from the heart, great things happen. And I'm sure Fiona can definitely say more about that.
You're muted.
I don't need you, Michael. Thank you. Thank you very much. And yeah.
We have about roughly 5 odd minutes. I just want to make a, it's not a sales promotion, but Michael would be conducting a mastery. I mean, many of our panelists here, or some of our panelists here, would all be delivering webinars, mastery webinars over the next year. Michael would soon be coming up with, again, creating awareness through the Buddhist medium and so on. He can mention a little bit about that. Fiona is coming with her transpersonal approach to coaching. Ram Charan, along with Kelly, would be coming with the self in coaching in a very, very different context. So there are many such people who, over the next year, we would like to present with Coach Arya as a platform in a much larger space than the 90 minutes colloquium. These would be 30-hour mastery webinars, which would give you the credentials as part of our ACTP program, which could be used for ACC, PCC, MCC, whatever you choose to use. We can incorporate that within our ACTP program. So I would like to leave it at that. But at this point in time, we have another about 5 minutes or so. We can take about a half a minute each to sum up, and Magda can come in and close the session, please. Thank you.
So Ram, I think Mauro raised this issue on forgiveness. And maybe I just want to say a few words on that. It's got specific relevance to the whole concept of Christianity as I know it, rooted in forgiveness. Whether it's God's forgiveness for our sins, or whether it's us forgiving ourselves, or whether it is us forgiving other people. And I think that's got tremendous tremendous applications in coaching. Because many of us, and me included, have been particularly harsh on our own selves in both the ability to love ourselves as we should, and in the ability to forgive ourselves in those points of time where we actually err. And in many ways, I see this as an area that one could potentially explore in the whole coaching paradigm. I'll just stop there.
I would say that for me today, there's a beautiful kind of living, passionate energy in the discussion. And I think, you know, we as coaches, when we come together, particularly this group, it's a very conscious coaching group that in these discussions, something really starts to come alive. And, you know, again, I think there's a great value in having these discussions, particularly across boundaries with people who I don't really know. To just kind of reinvigorate and give a lot of inspiration for bringing certain qualities into coaching work. And I will be doing a webinar on October 14th with Kelly that Ram mentioned. We look into some really depth aspects of presence coaching from various, you know, traditions, modern and ancient. So looking forward to continuing the discussion with all of you on this.
Please, others, just jump in. We have just a few minutes left.
So a lot of insights, a lot of perspectives to go back and reflect on, really, and find my own path.
I feel my heart so full, and it's been such a lovely time to be with kindred spirits.
Yeah, I echo that feeling. You know, I see so much of unity in our basic diversity. Thank you for that.
It's been a very moving experience for me to hear all of you, to learn from all of you, to realize how much that we have in common. I wrote a book a few years ago, and it's coaching across boundaries. The second part is rejoicing in our differences. And I think we have so much to learn from each other, and to have this opportunity to have an open discussion where we weren't really sure what was going to happen. I'm very moved and very, very inspired. So thank everyone. I thank you all.
Anyone else? Yeah, please.
Thank you. I'm deeply grateful. Thanks for the wisdom shared in the chat and all the other voices that came through from that platform as well. Thank you very much.
And I would like to express my appreciation and also acknowledge that I'm not exclusively coming from a Buddhist point of view. I have studied all religions, and I find and I learn from all religions all the time. So, you know, Judaism first affected me a long time ago with the concept of tikkun olam, which is to heal an ailing world. And so I find there's a lot of overlap with a lot of these religions. And I think once we get drilled down to the intention, and if the intention is kindness towards our fellow man in the service of love and peace, then I think we're all on the right track.
Thank you, Michael. Neshmita, anything?
Yes, can you hear me? Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just really grateful for the opportunity to be here and hear from all of you who have clearly explored, you know, your faith so much, so deeply. And like you all mentioned, it's just a very, I don't know the word, but it's a very comforting feeling to see how there's so much uniformity and basically it's all the same, but different with every faith. So that's just wonderful to see. Thank you.
Yep.